North Korea were still starving and suffering. Intelligence reports provided increased evidence that North Korea was continuing its highly enriched uranium program, even as it claimed to be shutting down its plutonium reprocessing. In the short run, I believe the six-party talks represented the best chance to maintain leverage on Kim Jong-il and rid the Korean Peninsula of nuclear weapons. In the long run, I am convinced the only path to meaningful change is for the North Korean people to be free. The freedom agenda was a sensitive subject with China. My policy was to engage the Chinese in areas where we agreed and use this cooperation to build the trust and credibility we needed to speak plainly about our differences. I worked to develop close relations with China's leaders, Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao. President Jiang and I got off to a rough start. On April 1, 2001, an American surveillance plane, known as an EP-3, collided with a Chinese aircraft and made an emergency landing on Hainan Island. The Chinese pilot ejected from the cockpit and died. Our 24-person crew was held at a military barracks on the island and interrogated. The Iranian hostage crisis was at the forefront of my mind. This was not the way I wanted to start my relationship with China. After several agonizing days of trying to reach the Chinese, I connected with President Jiang, who was in Chile. The Chinese soon agreed to release the EP-3 crew. In return, I wrote a letter expressing regret over the death of their pilot and our landing on Hainan without verbal clearance. I later learned that China's handling of the EP-3 crisis was based on the government's belief that the Chinese people had perceived weakness in the response to America's accidental bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade in 1999. After the EP-3 incident, the Chinese sent us a $1 million bill for the American crew's food and lodging. We offered them $34,000. In February 2002, Laura and I made our first trip to Beijing. President Jiang was a cordial and welcoming host. After a banquet in our honor at the Great Hall of the People, he entertained the crowd with a rendition of O Sole Mio, accompanied by two beautiful Chinese women clad in military uniforms. His serenade was a big change from the previous year when I couldn't get him on the phone. It was a sign we were developing trust. That trust was strengthened by an understanding on Taiwan, the island democracy that had been governed separately from the mainland since Chiang Kai-shek clashed with Mao Zedong during the Chinese Civil War in 1949. Every time I met with Chinese leaders, I confirmed that America's long-standing one-China policy would not change. I also made clear that I opposed any unilateral change to the status quo, including a declaration of independence by Taiwan or military action by China. When Hu Jintao took office, I was determined to forge a close relationship with him as well. 16 years younger than his predecessor, President Hu had an unexcitable demeanor and a keen analytical mind. Like many in the new generation of Chinese leaders, he was trained as an engineer. During a lunch in the East Room, I turned to him with the question that I like to ask fellow world leaders. What keeps you up at night? I told him I stayed awake worrying about another terrorist attack on America. He quickly replied that his biggest concern was creating 25 million new jobs a year. I found his answer fascinating. It was honest. It showed he was worried about the impact of disaffected, unemployed masses. It explained his government's policies in resource-rich places like Iran and Africa. And it was a signal that he was a practical leader focused inward, not an ideologue likely to stir up trouble abroad. I worked with President Hu to find common ground on issues from North Korea to climate change to trade. Expanding American access to China's 1 billion potential consumers was a high priority for me, just as access to the U.S. market was essential for the Chinese. I also saw trade as a tool to promote the freedom agenda. I believe that over time, the freedom inherent in the market would lead people to demand liberty in the public square. One of my first decisions was to continue President Clinton's support for China's entry into the World Trade Organization. To solidify our economic relationship, I asked Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson and Condi to create the Strategic Economic Dialogue. One area of disagreement with the Chinese leadership was human rights. My focus was on religious liberty, because I believe that allowing people to worship as they choose is a cornerstone of the freedom agenda. In one of our first meetings, I explained to President Jiang that faith was a vital part of my life and that I studied the Word every day. I told him I planned to raise freedom of worship in our conversations. "I read the Bible," he replied, "but I don't trust what it says." I told both Jiang and Hu that religious believers would be peaceful and productive citizens, the kind of people who would make their country stronger. I told them that for China to reach its full potential, they needed to trust their people with greater freedom. I didn't hector or lecture them. I let my actions send the message. Laura and I attended church in Beijing, met with religious leaders like Cardinal Joseph Zen of Hong Kong, and spoke out for the rights of Chinese underground preachers and worshipers, bloggers, dissidents, and political prisoners. At the 2007 APEC summit in Sydney, I told President Hu, "I plan to attend a ceremony where the Dalai Lama would receive the Congressional Gold Medal." The Buddhist leader was a source of distress for the Chinese government, which accused him of stirring up separatists in Tibet. I met with the Dalai Lama 5 times during my presidency, and I found him to be a charming, peaceful man. I told China's leaders they should not fear him. "This is not meant as a slap at China," I said, "but as a measure of my respect for the Dalai Lama and for the U.S. Congress. You know my strong belief in religious freedom." "This is a politically sensitive issue in China," President Hu replied. "It will draw a very strong reaction from the Chinese people." What he meant was that it would draw a strong reaction from the government, which did not want me to be the first American president to appear with the Dalai Lama in public. "I'm afraid that I have to go to that ceremony," I said. I also had some good news to share. "How is your Olympic planning coming?" I asked, referring to the 2008 Summer Games, which China had been chosen to host. He gave me an update on the construction process. I told him I was coming to the Games. I knew I would face pressure not to, and many would try to politicize the Olympics. But I promised he could count on me to attend. "I've got my hotel reservations already," I joked. He looked relieved. The Beijing Olympics were one of the highlights of my final year in office. I flew over on Air Force One with Laura and Barbara, my brother Marvin, my sister-in-law Margaret, and our friends Roland and Lois Betts, and Brad Freeman. Mother, Dad, and Doro met us in China. Dad and I joined Ambassador Sandy Rant, who served in Beijing all 8 years, to open a huge new American embassy. It was quite a change from the small diplomatic post Dad led 33 years earlier. In an extraordinary gesture of generosity, President Hu hosted a lunch for us all at the government's Zhongnanhai compound, a Bush family reunion like none before or since. The Beijing Olympics turned out to be a phenomenal success, and a lot of fun. We were at the water cube when the men's swimming team staged a dramatic comeback to edge out France for the gold medal in the freestyle relay. I dropped by to watch the impressive team of Misty May Trainer and Kerry Walsh practice for their beach volleyball match. I made international news by giving Misty a playful slap on the back, a little north of the traditional target. We visited the locker room before Team USA and China squared off in the most watched basketball game in history. The players couldn't have been more gracious or impressive. "Hey, Pops," LeBron James called out when Dad entered the room. The Olympics gave the world a chance to see the beauty and creativity of China. My hope is that the games also gave the Chinese people a glimpse of the wider world, including the possibility of an independent press, open internet, and free speech. Time will tell what the long-term impact of the Beijing Olympics will be. But history shows that once people get a taste of freedom, they eventually want more. November 23, 2002 was a rainy, gray day in Bucharest. Yet tens of thousands had turned out in Revolution Square to mark Romania's admission to NATO, a landmark development for a country that just 15 years earlier was a Soviet satellite state and a member of the Warsaw Pact. As I approached the stage, I noticed a brightly lit balcony. "What is that?" I asked the advance man. He told me that it was where Nicolae Ceausescu, the communist dictator of Romania, had given his last speech before he was overthrown in 1989. As President Ion Iliescu introduced me, the rain stopped, and a full spectrum rainbow appeared. It stretched across the sky and ended right behind the balcony that was lit as a memorial to freedom. It was a stunning moment. I ad-libbed, "God is smiling on us today." Romania was not the only young democracy celebrating that day. I had also cast America's vote to admit Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Slovakia, and Slovenia into NATO. I viewed NATO expansion as a powerful tool to advance the freedom agenda. Because NATO requires nations to meet high standards for economic and political openness, the possibility of membership acts as an incentive for reform. A year after my speech in Bucharest, a charismatic young Democrat named Mikhail Saakashvili burst into the opening session of parliament in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. Speaking for thousands of Georgian demonstrators, he denounced the assembly as the illegitimate result of a corrupt election. President Eduard Shevardnadze felt the groundswell and resigned. The bloodless coup became known as the Rose Revolution. 6 weeks later, the Georgian people went to the polls and chose Saakashvili to be their president. In November 2004, a similar wave of protests broke out after a fraudulent presidential election in Ukraine. Hundreds of thousands braved freezing temperatures to demonstrate for opposition candidate Viktor Yushchenko. At one point during the campaign, Yushchenko suffered a mysterious poisoning that disfigured his face, yet he refused to drop out of the race. His supporters turned out every day, clad in orange scarves and ribbons, until the Ukrainian Supreme Court ordered a rerun of the tainted election. Yushchenko won and was sworn in on January 23, 2005, completing the Orange Revolution. At the 2008 NATO summit in Bucharest, both Georgia and Ukraine applied for membership action plans, MAPs, the final step before consideration for full membership. I was a strong supporter of their applications. But approval required unanimity. Both Angela Merkel and Nicolas Sarkozy, the new president of France, were skeptical. They knew Georgia and Ukraine had tense relationships with Moscow, and they worried NATO could get drawn into a war with Russia. They were also concerned about corruption. I thought the threat from Russia strengthened the case for extending MAPs to Georgia and Ukraine. Russia would be less likely to engage in aggression if these countries were on a path into NATO. As for the governance issues, a step toward membership would encourage them to clean up corruption. We agreed on a compromise. We would not grant Georgia and Ukraine MAPs in Bucharest, but we would issue a statement announcing that they were destined for future membership in NATO. At the end of the debate, Prime Minister Gordon Brown of Great Britain leaned over to me and said, "We didn't give them MAPs, but we may have just made them members." The NATO debate over Georgia and Ukraine highlighted the influence of Russia. In my first meeting with Vladimir Putin in the spring of 2001, he complained that Russia was burdened by Soviet-era debt. At that point, oil was selling for $26 per barrel. By the time I saw Putin at the APEC summit in Sydney in September 2007, oil had reached $71, on its way to $137 in the summer of 2008. He leaned back in his chair and asked how were Russia's mortgage-backed securities doing. The comment was vintage Putin. He was sometimes cocky, sometimes charming, always tough. Over my 8 years as president, I met face-to-face with Vladimir more than 40 times. Laura and I had wonderful visits with him and his wife, Ludmilla, at our home in Crawford and his dacha outside Moscow, where he showed me his private chapel and let me drive his classic 1956 Volga. He took us on a beautiful boat ride through St. Petersburg during the White Nights Festival. I invited him to Kennebunkport, where we went fishing with Dad. I'll never forget Putin's reaction the first time he came into the Oval Office. It was early in the morning and the light was streaming through the south windows. As he stepped through the door, he blurted out, "My God, this is beautiful." It was quite a response for a former KGB agent from the atheist Soviet Union. Through all the ups and downs, Putin and I were candid with each other. We cooperated in some important areas, including fighting terrorism, removing the Taliban from Afghanistan, and securing nuclear materials. One of the biggest achievements emerged from our first meeting in Slovenia in 2001. I told Vladimir I planned to give him the required 6 months' notice that America would withdraw from the anti-ballistic missile treaty so that we could both develop effective missile defense systems. He made clear that this wouldn't make me popular in Europe. I told him I'd campaigned on the issue and the American people expected me to follow through. "The Cold War is over," I told Putin. "We are no longer enemies." I also informed him that America would unilaterally cut our arsenal of strategic nuclear warheads by 2/3. Putin agreed to match our reductions. Less than a year later, we signed the Moscow Treaty, which pledged our nations to shrink our number of deployed warheads from 6,600 weapons to between 1,700 and 2,200 by 2012. The treaty amounted to one of the largest nuclear weapon cuts in history, and it happened without the endless negotiations that usually come with arms control agreements. Over the course of 8 years, Russia's newfound wealth affected Putin. He became aggressive abroad and more defensive about his record at home. In our first one-on-one meeting of my second term in Bratislava, I raised my concerns about Russia's lack of progress on democracy. I was especially worried about his arrests of Russian businessmen and his crackdown on the free press. "Don't lecture me about the free press," he said. "Not after you fired that reporter." It dawned on me what he was referring to. "Vladimir, are you talking about Dan Rather?" I asked. He said he was. I said, "I strongly suggest you not say that in public. The American people will think you don't understand our system." At a joint press conference after the meeting, I called on two American reporters and Vladimir called on two Russian journalists. The last question came from Alexei Meshkov of the Interfax news agency. It was addressed to Putin. "President Bush recently stated that the press in Russia is not free," he said. "What is this lack of freedom all about? Why don't you talk a lot about violations of the rights of journalists in the United States, about the fact that some journalists have been fired?" What a coincidence. The so-called free press of Russia was parroting Vladimir's line. Putin and I both loved physical fitness. Vladimir worked out hard, swam regularly, and practiced judo. We were both competitive people. On his visit to Camp David, I introduced Putin to our Scottish Terrier, Barney. He wasn't very impressed. On my next trip to Russia, Vladimir asked if I wanted to meet his dog, Coney. "Sure," I said. As we walked the birch-lined grounds of his dacha, a big black Labrador came charging across the lawn. With a twinkle in his eye, Vladimir said, "Bigger, stronger, and faster than Barney." I later told the story to my friend, Prime Minister Stephen Harper of Canada. "You're lucky he only showed you his dog," he replied. The Barney story was instructive. Putin was a proud man who loved his country. He wanted Russia to have the stature of a great power again, and was driven to expand Russia's spheres of influence. He intimidated democracies on his borders and used energy as an economic weapon by cutting off natural gas to parts of Eastern Europe. Putin was wily. As a quid pro quo for supporting Jacques Chirac and Gerhard Schroeder in their efforts to counterbalance American influence, Putin convinced them to defend his consolidation of power in Russia. At a G8 dinner in St. Petersburg, most of the leaders challenged Putin on his democratic record. Jacques Chirac did not. He announced that Putin was doing a fine job running Russia, and it was none of our business how he did it. That was nothing compared to what Gerhard Schroeder did. Shortly after the German chancellor stepped down from office, he became chairman of a company owned by Gazprom, Russia's state-owned energy giant. Putin liked power, and the Russian people liked him. Huge oil-fed budget surpluses didn't hurt. He used his stature to handpick his successor, Dmitry Medvedev. Then he got himself appointed prime minister. The low point in our relationship came in August 2008, when Russia sent tanks across the border into Georgia to occupy South Ossetia and Abkhazia, two provinces that were part of Georgia but had close ties to Russia. I was in Beijing for the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games. Laura and I were standing in line to greet President Hu Jintao when Jim Jeffrey, my deputy national security advisor, whispered the news about Russia's offensive. I looked a few places ahead of me in line. There was Vladimir. I decided the receiving line was not the appropriate place for heated diplomacy. I also thought it was important that I direct my concerns to President Medvedev. I didn't know Medvedev well. In April 2008, just before the change of power, Vladimir had invited Medvedev to visit with us in Sochi, Russia's equivalent of Camp David. The mood was festive. Putin hosted a nice dinner, followed by folk dancing. At one point, members of my delegation, including me, were plucked from our seats to take the stage. The dance felt like a combination of square dancing and the jitterbug. I'm sure I would have been more fluid if I'd had a little vodka in my system. Curiously enough, I rarely saw vodka on my trips to Russia, unlike in the old days of communism. I appreciated the chance to spend time with Medvedev, Russia's first non-communist leader since the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917. He had given an impressive speech outlining his commitment to the rule of law, liberalizing the Russian economy and reducing corruption. I told him I was looking forward to dealing with him, president to president. The big question, of course, was whether he would actually run the country. As a way of testing, I asked Vladimir if he would still use the Sochi compound after Medvedev assumed office. "No," he said without hesitation. "This is the summer palace of the president." I called Medvedev when I got back to my hotel in Beijing. He was hot, so was I. "My strong advice is to start de-escalating this thing now," I said. "The disproportionality of your actions is going to turn the world against you. We're going to be with them." Medvedev told me Saakashvili was like Saddam Hussein. He claimed Saakashvili had launched an unprovoked, barbarian attack that had killed more than 1,500 civilians. "I hope you're not saying you're going to kill 1,500 people in response," I shot back. "You've made your point loud and clear," I said. "I hope you consider what I've asked very seriously." My biggest concern was that the Russians would storm all the way to Tbilisi and overthrow the democratically elected Saakashvili. It was clear the Russians couldn't stand a democratic Georgia with a pro-Western president. I wondered if they would have been as aggressive if NATO had approved Georgia's map application. I called Saakashvili next. He was understandably shaken. He described the Russian assault and urged me not to abandon Georgia. "I hear you," I said. "We do not want Georgia to collapse." In the coming days, I spoke out in defense of Georgia's territorial integrity, worked with President Sarkozy, who was serving as president of the European Union, to rally nations to call on Russia to withdraw, dispatched relief supplies to Georgia aboard U.S. military aircraft, and promised to help rebuild the Georgian military. At the opening ceremony of the Olympics, Laura and I were seated in the same row as Vladimir and his interpreter. This was the chance to have the conversation I had put off in the Great Hall. Laura and the man next to her, the King of Cambodia, shifted down a few seats. Putin slid in next to me. I knew the TV cameras would be on us, so I tried not to get overly animated. I told him he'd made a serious mistake, and that Russia would isolate itself if it didn't get out of Georgia. He said Saakashvili was a war criminal, the same term Medvedev had used, who had provoked Russia. "I've been warning you, Saakashvili is hot-blooded," I told Putin. "I'm hot-blooded, too," Putin retorted. I stared back at him. "No, Vladimir," I said. "You're cold-blooded." After a few weeks of intense diplomacy, Russia had withdrawn most of its invading troops, but they maintained an unlawful military presence in South Ossetia and Abkhazia. Vladimir Putin called me during my last week in office to wish me well, which was a thoughtful gesture. Still, given what I'd hoped Putin and I could accomplish in moving past the Cold War, Russia stands out as a disappointment in the freedom agenda. Russia was not the only one. I was hopeful that Egypt would be a leader for freedom and reform in the Arab world, just as it had been a leader for peace under Anwar Sadat a generation before. Unfortunately, after a promising presidential election in 2005 that included opposition candidates, the government cracked down during the legislative elections later that year, jailing dissidents and bloggers who advocated a democratic alternative. Venezuela also slid back from democracy. President Hugo Chavez polluted the airways with hardcore anti-American sermons while spreading a version of phony populism that he termed the Bolivarian Revolution. Sadly, he squandered the Venezuelan people's money and is ruining their country. He is becoming the Robert Mugabe of South America. Regrettably, the leaders of Nicaragua, Bolivia, and Ecuador have followed his example. There are other isolated outposts of tyranny, places like Belarus, Burma, Cuba, and Sudan. My hope is that America will continue to stand with the dissidents and freedom advocates there. I met with more than 100 dissidents over the course of my presidency. Their plight can look bleak, but it is not hopeless. As I said in my second inaugural address, the freedom agenda demands the concentrated work of generations. Once change arrives, it often moves quickly, as the world saw in the European revolutions of 1989 and the rapid transformation of East Asia after World War II. When the people are finally set free, it is often the dissidents and the prisoners, people like Vaclav Havel and Nelson Mandela, who emerge as the leaders of their free countries. Despite the setbacks for the freedom agenda, there were many more examples of hope and progress. Georgians and Ukrainians joined the ranks of free peoples. Kosovo became an independent nation, and NATO expanded from 19 members to 26. Under the courageous leadership of President Alvaro Uribe, Colombia's democracy reclaimed its sovereign territory from narco-terrorists. With support from the United States, multi-ethnic democracies from India and Indonesia to Brazil and Chile became leaders in their regions and models for developing free societies around the world. The most dramatic advances for freedom came in the Middle East. In 2001, the region saw terrorism on the rise, raging violence between Palestinians and Israelis, the destabilizing influence of Saddam Hussein, Libya developing weapons of mass destruction, tens of thousands of Syrian troops occupying Lebanon, Iran pressing ahead unopposed with a nuclear weapons program, widespread economic stagnation and little progress toward political reform. By 2009, nations across the Middle East were actively fighting terrorism instead of looking the other way. Iraq was a multi-religious, multi-ethnic democracy, and an ally of the United States. Libya had renounced its weapons of mass destruction and resumed normal relations with the world. The Lebanese people had kicked out Syrian troops and restored democracy. The Palestinian people had an increasingly peaceful government on the West Bank and momentum toward a democratic state that would live side by side with Israel in peace. And Iran's freedom movement was active after the summer 2009 presidential election. Throughout the region, economic reform and political openness were beginning to advance. Kuwait held its first election in which women were allowed to vote and hold office. In 2009, women won several seats. Women also held government positions in Oman, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, and Yemen. Bahrain named a Jewish female ambassador to the United States. Jordan, Morocco, and Bahrain held competitive parliamentary elections. While it remains a highly ordered monarchy, Saudi Arabia held its first municipal elections. And King Abdullah founded the kingdom's first university, open to both Saudi women and men. Across the region, trade and investment expanded. Internet use rose sharply. And conversations about democracy and reform grew louder, especially among women, who I am confident will lead the freedom movement throughout the Middle East. In January 2008, I traveled to Abu Dhabi and Dubai, two Arab emirates that had embraced free trade and open societies. Their downtown centers boasted glittering skyscrapers filled with entrepreneurs and business professionals, men and women alike. In Dubai, I visited with university students studying in fields as diverse as business, science, and history. On the last night of my visit, the forward-looking Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, my friend, Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, invited me to his desert retreat for a traditional dinner. He told me a number of government officials would join us. I expected middle-aged men, but I was wrong. The Crown Prince's government included young, smart Muslim women. They spoke about their determination to continue reform and progress, and to deepen their friendship with the United States. The sands of Abu Dhabi were a long way from the inaugural platform that I stood atop in January 2005. But in the desert that night, I saw the future of the Middle East, a region that honors its ancient culture while embracing the modern world. It will take decades for the changes set in motion in recent years to be fully realized. There will be setbacks along the way, but I am confident in the destination. The people of the Middle East will be free, and America will be more secure as a result. Chapter 14, Financial Crisis. Mr. President, we are witnessing a financial panic. Those were troubling words coming from Ben Bernanke, the mild-mannered chairman of the Federal Reserve, who was seated across from me in the Roosevelt Room. Over the previous 2 weeks, the government had seized Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, two giant housing entities. Lehman Brothers had filed the largest bankruptcy in American history. Merrill Lynch had been sold under duress. The Fed had granted an $85 billion loan to save AIG. Now, Wachovia and Washington Mutual were teetering on the brink of collapse. With so much turbulence in financial institutions, credit markets had seized up. Consumers couldn't get loans for homes or cars. Small businesses couldn't borrow to finance their operations. The stock market had taken its steepest plunge since the first day of trading after 9/11. As we sat beneath the oil painting of Teddy Roosevelt charging on horseback, we all knew America was facing its most dire economic challenge in decades. I turned to the rough rider of my financial team, Secretary of the Treasury Hank Paulson, a natural leader with decades of experience in international finance. "The situation is extraordinarily serious," Hank said. He and the team briefed me on three measures to stem the crisis. First, The Treasury would guarantee all $3.5 trillion in money market mutual funds, which were facing depositor runs. Second, the Fed would launch a program to unfreeze the market for commercial paper, a key source of financing for businesses across the country. Third, the Securities and Exchange Commission would issue a rule temporarily preventing the short selling of financial stocks. These are dramatic steps, Hank said, but America's financial system is at stake. He outlined an even bolder proposal. We need broad authority to buy mortgage-backed securities, he said. Those complex financial assets had lost value when the housing bubble burst, imperiling the balance sheets of financial firms around the world. Hank recommended that we ask Congress for hundreds of billions to buy up these toxic assets and restore confidence in the banking system. Is this the worst crisis since the Great Depression? I asked. Yes, Ben replied. In terms of the financial system, we have not seen anything like this since the 1930s, and it could get worse. His answer clarified the decision I faced. Did I want to be the president overseeing an economic calamity that could be worse than the Great Depression? I was furious the situation had reached this point. A relatively small group of people, many on Wall Street, some not, had gambled that the housing market would keep booming forever. It didn't. In a normal environment, the free market would render its judgment, and they could fail. I would have been happy to let them do so. But this was not a normal environment. The market had ceased to function. And as Ben had explained, the consequences of inaction would be catastrophic. As unfair as it was to use the American people's money to prevent a collapse for which they weren't responsible, it would be even more unfair to do nothing and leave them to suffer the consequences. Get to work, I said, approving Hank's plan in full. We are going to solve this. I adjourned the meeting and walked across the hallway to the Oval Office. Josh Bolton, Counselor Ed Gillespie, and Dana Perino, my talented and effective press secretary, followed me in. Ben's historical comparison was still echoing in my mind. If we're really looking at another Great Depression, I said, you can be damn sure I'm going to be Roosevelt, not Hoover. Almost exactly 25 years earlier, in October 1983, I was drinking coffee in Midland with a Harvard Business School friend, Tom Canab. We heard someone mention that a line was forming outside the doors of Midland's First National Bank. First National was Texas's largest independent bank. It had been a fixture in Midland for 93 years. Recently, rumors had been flying about the bank's precarious financial position. First National had issued many of its loans when oil prices were rising. Then in the early 1980s, the price of crude dropped from almost $40 per barrel to under $30. The pace of drilling slowed. Loans defaulted. Depositors withdrew their cash. I transferred our exploration company's account to a big New York bank. I was not going to gamble on First National solvency. Tom and I hustle over to the bank. From the second floor balcony, we watched people line up in the lobby to approach the teller's windows. Some carried paper sacks. Amid the crowd was a prominent old rancher, Frank Cowden. Like other West Texas ranchers, Mr. Cowden was fortunate that his land overlay a lot of oil. He was a large shareholder of First National. He was working the line, telling people that the federal government insured every deposit up to $100,000. The people just stared back at him. They wanted their money. On October 14, 1983, the FDIC seized First National and sold it to First Republic in Dallas. The depositors were protected, but the shareholders were wiped out, and a Midland institution was gone. Mayor Thane Atkins spoke for a lot of folks when he said, "I feel like hanging a black wreath on my door." I had read about the financial panics of 1893 and 1929. Now I had witnessed firsthand the bursting of a speculative bubble. First National, like all financial institutions, depended on the confidence of its customers. Once that confidence was lost, the bank had no chance to survive. 16 years later, I was running for president. By nearly all measures, the economy was booming. America's GDP had increased by more than $2.5 trillion since the recession that had cost Dad the election, but ended before he left office. Fueled by new internet stocks, the NASDAQ index had shot up from under 500 to over 4,000. Some economists argued that the internet era had redefined the business cycle. I wasn't so sure. Sometimes economists are wrong, I said in a speech outlining my economic policy in December 1999. I can remember recoveries that were supposed to end but didn't, and recessions that weren't supposed to happen but did. I hope for continued growth, but it is not guaranteed. A president must work for the best case and prepare for the worst. The centerpiece of my plan was an across-the-board tax cut. I believed government was taking too much of the people's money. By the end of 1999, taxes accounted for a higher percentage of GDP than they had at any point since World War II. The government was supposedly running a large surplus. I knew where that money would go. Government would find a way to spend it. After all, Congress and President Clinton had agreed to increase non-security discretionary spending by more than 16% in fiscal year 2001. I had another reason for supporting tax cuts. I worried that we could be witnessing another bubble, this one in the technology sector. Larry Lindsay, my top economic advisor, believed the country was headed for a recession. If he was right, the tax cuts would act as a vital stimulus. Sure enough, a recession officially began in March 2001. The New York Times considered the downturn a positive development for me. One article ran under the headline, "For the President, a Perfect Time for a Recession." It sure didn't feel that way to me. I couldn't help but note a strange irony of history. In 1993, Dad had left behind an economy much better than the public realized. Now, I had inherited one much worse. With the economy tanking, the tax cuts took on a new urgency. I pressed Congress to move quickly. In June 2001, I signed a $1.35 trillion tax cut, the largest since the one Ronald Reagan signed during his first term. The bill reduced marginal tax rates for every income taxpayer, including millions of small business owners, doubled the child tax credit from $500 to $1,000, reduced the marriage penalty, and eliminated the lowest tax bracket, which removed 5 million low-income families from the tax rolls. The bill also phased out the death tax, a burden that was unfair to small business owners, farmers, and ranchers. I figured Americans had paid enough taxes while they were living. They shouldn't be taxed again when they died. I was optimistic that consumers and small businesses would spend their tax relief to help pull the economy out of the recession. But we were in for another massive economic hit that no one expected. The toll of 9/11 will always be measured by the 2,973 lives stolen and many others devastated. But the economic cost was shattering as well. The New York Stock Exchange shut down for 4 days, the longest suspension of trading since the Great Depression. When the markets reopened, the Dow Jones plunged 684 points, the biggest single-day drop in history to that point. The impact of the attacks rippled throughout the economy. Tourism plummeted. Several airlines filed for bankruptcy. Many restaurants sat virtually empty. Some hotels reported business being down as much as 90%. Manufacturers and small businesses laid off workers as skittish buyers canceled their orders. By the end of the year, more than 1 million Americans had lost their jobs. The United States and the rest of the world are likely to experience a full-blown recession now, one economist predicted. That was what the terrorists intended. Al-Qaeda spent $500,000 on the event, Osama bin Laden later bragged, while America lost, according to the lowest estimate, $500 billion. He outlined what he called a bleed-until-bankruptcy strategy and said, "It is very important to concentrate on hitting the U.S. economy through all possible means." I saw it as my responsibility to encourage Americans to defy al-Qaeda by keeping the economy moving. In late September 2001, I flew to Chicago's O'Hare Airport to promote the recovery of the airline industry. I walked onto a riser in front of 737s from American and United Airlines. With 6,000 airline workers in the audience, I said, "One of the great goals of this nation's war is to restore public confidence in the airline industry. It's to tell the traveling public, get on board. Do your business around the country." Later, I would be mocked and criticized for telling Americans to go shopping after 9/11. I never actually used that phrase, but that's beside the point. In the threat-filled months after 9/11, traveling on airplanes, visiting tourist destinations, and yes, going shopping, were acts of defiance and patriotism. They helped businesses rebound and hard-working Americans keep their jobs. I was surprised by critics who suggested I should have asked for more sacrifice after 9/11. I suppose it's easy for some to forget, but people were making sacrifices. Record numbers of volunteers had stepped forward to help their neighbors. Even our youngest citizens pitched in. Students across the country donated $10 million, often $1 at a time, to a fund we created to benefit Afghan children. In my 2002 State of the Union address, I launched a new national service initiative, USA Freedom Corps, and called on all Americans to devote 4,000 hours to serving others over the course of their lifetimes. The bravest volunteers were those who risked their lives by joining or reenlisting in the military, FBI, or CIA. Hundreds of thousands made that noble choice in the years after 9/11. Many served multiple tours of duty away from their families. Thousands of our finest citizens gave their lives. To suggest that this country didn't sacrifice after 9/11 is offensive and wrong. Short of a military draft, a step I strongly opposed, I'm not sure what more I could have done to encourage sacrifice. This was a different kind of war. We didn't need riveters or victory gardens like we had during World War II. We needed people to deny the enemy the panic they sought to create. I've always believed that the critics who alleged I wasn't asking people to sacrifice were really complaining that I hadn't raised taxes. Taxes are more than a device to raise revenue, one Washington Post columnist wrote. They are a statement of consensus on national purpose. I reject the premise that higher taxes would have led to stronger national purpose. I am convinced raising taxes after the devastation of 9/11 would have hurt our economy and had the opposite effect. September 11th, 2001, changed American life. It also transformed the federal budget. The projected surplus of early 2001 had been based on bullish forecasts for strong economic growth. The bursting of the tech bubble and subsequent recession significantly lowered those projections. The economic damage caused by the terrorist attacks drove them down even more. Then we faced the essential cost of securing the country and fighting the war on terror. In November 2001, Mitch Daniels, a fiscal hawk from Indiana, who ably led my Office of Management and Budget, delivered the official report. The so-called surplus had vanished in 10 months. For years, I listened to politicians from both sides of the aisle allege that I had squandered the massive surplus I inherited. That never made sense. Much of the surplus was an illusion, based on the mistaken assumption that the 1990s boom would continue. Once the recession and 9/11 hit, there was little surplus left. By the end of 2002, the recession was technically over, but the economy remained sluggish. In early January 2003, I called on Congress to accelerate the tax cuts from 2001, which had not fully taken effect, and to pass further tax cuts that would encourage business investment and job creation. While the 2001 tax cuts passed with bipartisan majorities, as did a modest tax cut in 2002 focused on small businesses, the 2003 version ran into serious opposition. The left denounced the plan as tax cuts for the rich. That charge was false. The Bush tax cuts, when fully implemented, actually increased the portion of the income tax burden that fell on the wealthiest Americans. Other critics opposed the tax cuts because they would drive up the deficit. It was true that tax cuts increased the deficit in the short term, but I believed the tax cuts, especially those on capital gains and dividends, would stimulate economic growth. The tax revenues from that growth, combined with spending restraint, would help lower the deficit. The tax relief bill made it through the House by a vote of 231 to 200. The tally in the Senate was deadlocked at 50. Dick Cheney went to Capitol Hill to break the tie in his constitutional role as president of the Senate. Fortunately, he voted yes. He joked that he didn't get to cast many votes as vice president, but when he did, he was always on the winning side. I signed the tax cuts into law in late May 2003. By September, the economy had started adding jobs again. It didn't stop for 46 consecutive months. After reaching a peak of 6.3% in June, the unemployment rate dropped for five of the next 6 months and averaged 5.3% during my presidency, lower than the averages of the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s. Some argued that the timing of the recovery right after the tax cuts was a coincidence. I don't think so. Amid the economic growth, I was mindful that the country was running deficits. I took my responsibility to be a good fiscal steward seriously. So did my four budget directors, Mitch Daniels, Josh Bolton, Rob Portman, and Jim Nussle. As a wartime president, I told them I had two priorities, protecting the homeland and supporting our troops, both in combat and as veterans. Beyond those areas, we submitted budgets that slowed the growth of discretionary spending every year of my presidency. For the last 5 years, my budgets held this spending growth below the rate of inflation, in real terms, a cut. I worked closely with Congress to meet my spending targets, or as I called it, the overall size of the pie. I didn't always agree with how Congress divvied up the pieces. I objected to wasteful earmarks inserted into spending bills. But I had no line item veto to excise pork barrel spending projects. I had to either accept or reject the bills in full. So long as Congress met my bottom line, which it did year after year, I felt that I should hold up my end of the deal and sign the bills. The results have been a subject of heated debate. Some on the left complained that tax cuts increased the deficits. Some on the right argued that I should not have signed the expensive Medicare prescription drug benefit. It is fair to debate those policy choices, but here are the facts. The combination of tight budgets and the rising tax revenues resulting from economic growth helped drive down the deficit from 3.5% of the GDP in 2004 to 2.6% in 2005 to 1.9% in 2006 to 1.2% in 2007. The average deficit to GDP ratio during my administration was 2%, below the 50-year average of 3%. My administration's ratios of spending to GDP, taxes to GDP, deficit to GDP, and debt to GDP are all lower than the averages of the past three decades, and in most cases, below the averages of my recent predecessors. Despite the cost of two recessions, the costliest natural disaster in history, and a two-front war, our fiscal record was strong. At the same time, I knew I was leaving behind a serious, long-term fiscal problem. The unsustainable growth in entitlement spending, which accounts for the vast majority of the future federal debt. I pushed hard to reform the funding formulas for Social Security and Medicare, but Democrats opposed my efforts, and support of my own party was lukewarm. Part of the problem was that the fiscal crisis seemed a long way off to the legislative branch while I was in office. In early 2008, the Congressional Budget Office estimated that the debt would not exceed 60% of GDP until 2023. But because of the financial crisis and spending choices made after I left office, debt will exceed that level by the end of 2010. A fiscal crisis that many saw as distant is now upon us. Wall Street got drunk, and we got the hangover. That was an admittedly simplistic way of describing the origins of the greatest financial panic since the Great Depression. A more sophisticated explanation dates back to the boom of the 1990s. While the U.S. economy grew at an annual rate of 3.8%, developing Asian countries, such as China, India, and South Korea, averaged almost twice that. Many of these economies stockpiled large cash reserves. So did energy-producing nations, which benefited from a tenfold rise in oil prices between 1993 and 2008. Ben Bernanke called this phenomenon a global saving glut. Others deemed it a giant pool of money. A great deal of this foreign capital flowed back to the United States. America was viewed as an attractive place to invest, thanks to our strong capital markets, reliable legal system, and productive workforce. Foreign investors bought large numbers of U.S. Treasury bonds, which drove down their yield. Naturally, investors started looking for higher returns. One prospect was the booming U.S. housing market. Between 1993 and 2007, the average American home price roughly doubled. Builders constructed homes at a rapid pace. Interest rates were low. Credit was easy. Lenders wrote mortgages for almost anyone, including subprime borrowers, whose low credit scores made them a higher risk. Wall Street spotted an opportunity. Investment banks purchased large numbers of mortgages from lenders, sliced them up, repackaged them, and converted them into complex financial securities. Credit rating agencies, which received lucrative fees from investment banks, blessed many of these assets with AAA ratings. Financial firms sold huge numbers of credit default swaps, bets on whether the mortgages underlying the securities would default. Trading under fancy names such as collateralized debt obligations, the new mortgage-based products yielded the returns investors were seeking. Wall Street sold them aggressively. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, private companies with congressional charters and lax regulation, fueled the market for mortgage-backed securities. The two government-sponsored enterprises bought up half the mortgages in the United States, securitized many of the loans, and sold them around the world. Investors bought voraciously because they believed Fannie and Freddie paper carried a U.S. government guarantee. It wasn't just overseas investors who were attracted by higher returns. American banks borrowed large sums of money against their capital, a practice known as leverage, and loaded up on the mortgage-backed securities. Some of the most aggressive investors were giant new financial service companies. Many had taken advantage of the 1999 repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act of 1932, which prohibited commercial banks from engaging in the investment business. At the height of the housing boom, home ownership hit an all-time high of almost 70%. I had supported policies to expand home ownership, including down payment assistance for low-income and first-time buyers. I was pleased to see the ownership society grow. But the exuberance of the moment masked the underlying risk. Together, the global pool of cash, easy monetary policy, booming housing market, insatiable appetite for mortgage-backed assets, complexity of Wall Street financial engineering, and leverage of financial institutions created a house of cards. This precarious structure was fated to collapse as soon as the underlying card, the non-stop growth of housing prices, was pulled out. That was clear in retrospect. But very few saw it at the time, including me. In May 2006, Josh Bolton walked into the treaty room with a guest he was trying to recruit to the administration, Goldman Sachs CEO Henry Paulson. I hoped to persuade Hank to succeed Secretary of the Treasury John Snow, John had been an effective advocate of my economic agenda, from tax cuts to Social Security reform to free trade. He had done a good job of managing the department and left it in better shape than he'd found it. He had been on the job for more than 3 years, and both John and I felt it was time for a fresh face. Josh told me Hank was a hard charger, smart, energetic, and credible with the financial markets. Hank was slow to warm to the idea of joining my cabinet. He had an exciting job on Wall Street and doubted he could accomplish much in the final years of my administration. He had a fine reputation and did not want his name dragged through the political mud. He was an avid conservationist who loved to fly fish for tarpon and watch birds with his wife Wendy, interests he might not be able to pursue. While Hank was a lifelong Republican, he was a party of one within his family. Wendy was a college friend and supporter of Hillary Clinton's. Their two children were disillusioned with the Republican Party. I later learned that Hank's mother cried when she first heard he was joining my cabinet. In his steady, low-key way, Josh eventually persuaded Hank to visit with me in the White House. Hank radiated energy and confidence. His hands moved as if he were conducting his own orchestra. He had a distinct way of speaking that could be hard to follow. Some said his brain was moving too fast for his mouth to keep up. That didn't bother me. People accused me of having the same problem. Hank understood the globalization of finance, and his name commanded respect at home and abroad. When I assured him he would be my primary economic advisor and have unlimited access, he accepted the offer. I was grateful to Wendy and Hank's family for supporting him. At the time, none of us realized his tests as Treasury Secretary would rival those of Henry Morgenthau under FDR or Alexander Hamilton at the founding of the country. When I took office, I became the fourth president to serve with Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan. Created under President Woodrow Wilson in 1913, the Fed sets America's monetary policy and coordinates with other central banks around the world. Its decisions have a wide-ranging impact, from the strength of the dollar to the interest rate on a local loan. While its chairman and board of governors are appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate, the Fed sets monetary policy independently from the White House and Congress. That's the way it should be. An independent Fed is a crucial sign of stability to financial markets and investors around the globe. I invited Greenspan to the White House for regular lunches. Dick Cheney, Andy Card, and I would eat. Alan would not. He spent all his time answering our questions. His grasp of data was astounding. I would ask him where he saw the economy headed over the next few months. He would quote oil inventories, changes in freight miles in the railroad industry, and other interesting statistics. As he rattled off the figures, he slapped his left hand against his right fist, as if to jar more information loose. When his position came up for renewal in 2004, I never considered appointing anyone else. When Alan sent word that he would retire in early 2006, we started the search for a successor. One name kept coming up, Ben Bernanke. Ben had served 3 years on the Fed board and joined my